Continuing on with Mark Curtis's Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam, published by Serpent's Tail. This is the new updated version, 2012, first published 2010. And this is show 164, if I'm remembering correctly, because I'm not on the computer at the moment to check. But anyway, following up from the 1980s, he was talking about the dictator Pakistan Zia, the king of Saudi Arabia, and the Ayatollah, what's happened there after the 70s training in Afghanistan, 70s and 80s, the Afghan jihad against the Soviet Union trying to stop defeat of communism or something like that. So chapter 10 gets way more up to date. And oh yes, a note, this is I'm only starting to catch up with where I am, up to page 215 of a 370 page book, so there may be a pause in the series here. It's been going along pretty regularly. I've also gotten sidetracked with Vine Deloria Jr.'s book C.G. Jung and the Sioux Traditions, Dreams, Visions, Nature, and the Primitive. Fascinating look, as Carl Jung visited the Taos Pueblo in 1925, and it had a major influence on his life and his work. And so Deloria Jr. compares some of his work with the native ways, and sometimes where Jung was tuning in quite nicely, and other times where his Western European background just and lack of experience with native peoples just didn't quite convey it. But anyway, so that's so you know for what's happening. And so I got chapter 11 I read, so I might get another show or two out of it before I pause. So anyway, chapter 10, Nurturing Al-Qaeda. The early 1990s brought Islamist terrorism to both Europe and the U.S. for the first time, with the first jihadist war in Europe. Bosnia after 1992, the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York in 93, and the first attacks in Western Europe. The 1995 bombs on the Paris Metro. Saudi Arabia also suffered its first major terrorist attacks in November 95, when a van bomb blew up an office housing a U.S. military mission training the National Guard, and in June 96, when the Khobar Towers skyscraper housing the U.S. Air Force personnel was hit by a massive truck bomb, killing 20 people. Numerous other countries were also affected by terrorism. Algeria was plagued by a brutal civil war between government and Islamist forces, which cost 100,000 lives after it broke out in 92. In Afghanistan, Mujahideen factions fell on each other after the fall of the Soviet-backed government in 92, killing thousands and destroying the capital, Kabul. Their vicious lawlessness prepared the way for the Taliban's later assumption of power. India and various Central Asian states also witnessed a surge in terrorism promoted by Pakistani groups seeking to, quote, liberate, end quote, Indian-controlled Kashmir and extend Islamist revolution. These were the ugly products of globalization of terrorism, of a globalization of terrorism, as militant jihadists, drawing on the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s and trained in Afghan and Pakistani camps, returned home to fight their own governments, trying to emulate their success against Soviets. I have a note here that this is like the opposite of what we're seeing in Standing Rock, where, you know, 300 more native nations of Turtle Island came together, plus Aztecs and Sami from Norway and other indigenous around the world coming together. Different vibe. Different way. I see this is sort of the story of our times, with these extreme differences of people coming together And then the sort of empire of chaos theory of splintering aparts. The jihadist ideology had evolved into what the French analyst Gilles Kepel had described as jihadi Salafist, demanding a return to the traditions of the devout ancestors Salafi in Arabic and an adherence to the sacred texts in their most literal sense. This meant a commitment to violence and to challenging what was regarded as the moderation of groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood, which were criticized for participating in elections and giving false religious legitimacy to regimes that should be overthrown. A further boost to this process was provided by an ongoing Saudi patronage of some of these forces alongside a gradual reduction of Saudi funds to the Muslim Brotherhood. The latter incurred Saudi wrath by supporting Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which also appeared to threaten Saudi Arabia. The Brotherhood's influence was being eclipsed by more violent groups now on the scene, and it was the jihadists that the Saudis needed to cultivate to propagate Wahhabi Islam and ensure the survival of the House of Saud. And perhaps you remember those photos, the George Jr. Bush there shaking hands with various, smiling a bit too widely, in my opinion, with the Saudis. In the summer of 1993, amidst this growing militancy, British intelligence prepared a report for the Foreign Office entitled Islamic Fundamentalism in the Middle East. It amounts to a neat summary of some of the beliefs that have led British officials to collaborate with radical Islamists. The report outlined M16's view on the origins and impact of fundamentalism, noting that it breeds on failure to resolve economic and social problems, corruption in government, and the bankruptcy of political ideologies, communism, Nasserism, Ba'athism, etc. These were, of course, ideologies which the British had done their utmost to undermine, thus paving the way for the advance of fundamentalism. The report also showed that the officials were aware that private Saudi and Gulf money donated for Islamic causes is a common factor in much of the region, as they continue to deepen their support for these regimes. So yeah, the communism, Nasserism, as we've learned from the earlier part of the show, Ba'athism, I'm not as familiar with. And that's the first couple pages of the chapter. Then the report recognized Islam's potential as a focus of opposition, offering a ready-made ideology emphasizing social justice, and also crucially that fundamentalism is not necessarily synonymous with political radicalism or anti-Western policies, a revealing comment and a key reason why Britain had been collaborating with these groups for so long. The report continued, the fundamentalist groups advocating violence and revolution are in a minority. Nevertheless, there is a strong anti-Western streak in all main political fundamentalist movements in the region. Western, particularly American, culture and materialism are seen as a threat to Islamic values. The fundamentalists' wider objectives are more or less incompatible with Western liberal principles. They are opposed to political pluralism, religious tolerance, and women's rights. This last point was surely correct, but these were also features of virtually every government that Britain had supported in the Middle East for decades, precisely to counter more pluralist governments more supportive of, say, women's rights. And later on, the analysis that Britain could have manageable relations with fundamentalist groups is highly revealing. The belief that fundamentalism does not pose a strategic threat to Western interests helps explain why Britain collaborated with these groups against forces that did pose such a threat, notably Nasserism. And the next bit of the chapter, Saving the Saudis and Their Financial Empire. After Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August 1990, the Saudi regime contributed over $50 billion to the U.S. and U.K.-led war, which annihilated Iraqi's army in February 1991. The conflict handed a massive boost to radical Sunni Islam. The conflict handed a massive boost to radical Sunni Islam. In meetings with the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki, and T-U-R-K-I, and Defense Minister Prince Sultan, bin Laden offered the use of his battle-hardened Arab-Afghan forces in defense of the kingdom. But the Saudis rejected those overtures, opting instead for the deployment of 500,000 infidel U.S. forces in the land of the two holy places. The reality was obvious. The Saudis were totally dependent on the U.S. for their survival. The jihadist groups committed to eradicating the Western presence from Saudi Arabia now saw the Saudi rulers as having betrayed Islam and would more easily find recruits to their causes within Saudi Arabia, which was soon targeted for terrorist attacks. And later on, during the war, the U.S. encouraged the Shias of southern Iraq to rise in revolt against Saddam. But once this duly began in March 1991, Washington allowed Iraqi forces to regroup and brutally crush the revolt, slaughtering thousands. U.S. aircraft flew above Iraqi helicopters, in effect giving them protection, while at one point in the uprising, U.S. troops stopped the Shia rebels from reaching an arms depot to attain ammunition. Washington preferred to keep Saddam in power rather than unleash forces that might be allied to its enemy, the Islamic Republic of Iran. So too with Britain, which had also initially encouraged the rebels. M16, along with the CIA, helped set up the Free Iraq radio station, which broadcast Anglo-American propaganda throughout the country. One British intelligence official, when asked about the earlier appeals for revolt, replied, "We hadn't thought it through properly." This was nonsense. Both London and Washington's urging of the Shias to revolt was classic policy. Using Islamic forces to achieve specific short-term objectives, in this case to destabilize Saddam's regime and pave the way for Iraq's ouster from Kuwait. Once this objective had been achieved, these forces became expendable, by now a very familiar pattern in Anglo-American connivance with Islamic forces in the region. And further down in my notes, I put a word that I'd seen redacted tonight, Lee Camp's news satire comedy. The phrase "for against," how these a lot of politicians are both, can be both for and against the same darn thing, so for against. As U.S. troops were massacring Saddam's forces from their bases in Saudi Arabia, bin Laden turned virtually overnight from being a supporter to an opponent of the Saudi regime. At the same time, he was continuing to recruit volunteers, many of them Saudi, for guerrilla training in his camps in Afghanistan in preparation for the upcoming jihad. Rather than expelling bin Laden from Saudi Arabia, however, the Saudis reportedly tried in early 1991 to broker a deal with him, whereby bin Laden would leave Saudi Arabia in return for the Saudis providing money to supply his Arab-Afghan forces, and on condition that Saudi Arabia itself would not be targeted by terrorism. While appearing to have been expelled from Saudi Arabia, bin Laden moved to Sudan in 1992, where Hassan al-Turabi's National Islamic Front regime offered him a new base. However, the Saudis never encouraged the Sudanese to take any action against him. Rather, bin Laden may have remained on their payroll. Oh my gosh. It was only in April 94, after continual open criticisms of the House of Saud, that the Saudis revoked bin Laden's citizenship. Even after this, however, they apparently kept trying to buy him off, some analysts claim. Thus, in 1996, the Saudis, still fearful, presumably of bin Laden-inspired attacks in the kingdom, reportedly gave their blessing to a secret deal bin Laden struck with a Pakistani military officer with close links to ISI, in which the latter would continue to supply al-Qaeda with protection and arms. It has also been alleged by some intelligence sources that in the same year, a group of Saudi princes and business leaders met in Paris and agreed to continue aiding bin Laden's terrorist network. A 2010 report by French intelligence expert Jean-Charles Brissard noted that at least 300 million had flowed to al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups in previous years, most from private Saudi donors and charities. U.S. intelligence was reporting the Saudi funding of terrorism by the mid-1990s, at least. A classified CIA report from 1996 revealed by the U.S. media in 2003 stated that Islamic activists can dominate the leadership of the largest charities and that even high-ranking members of the collecting or monitoring agencies in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Pakistan, such as the High Saudi Commission, are involved in illegal activities, including supported for terrorists. It is scarcely credible that the British weren't also aware of this alleged Saudi role. And that's an example of what I mentioned last time, where the evidence is not, when the evidence is not 100% clear, but Curtis gives a lot of evidence to say that is scarcely credible that, blah, blah, blah. And further mention of the preaching of Wahhabi mullahs teaching inside newly built mosques and religious schools reaching Muslims from North Africa to Central Asia. Saudi banks and charities led the charge, acting as the primary vehicles to finance the spread of Islamic fundamentalism. Much of the Saudi and other Arab money in the Islamic financial system was managed by American and European banks, while some terrorist groups also apparently used British banks to set up some of their accounts. The account of the Advice and Reformation Committee, bin Laden's front organization in London, received funds from banks in Sudan, Dubai, and the United Arab Emirates. From London, this money was transferred to Al-Qaeda cells in Western cities and to several Islamic centers and charities in locations including Bosnia, Kosovo, and Albania. There was, however, little political will on either side of the Atlantic before 9/11 to monitor and control terrorist financing. There is no evidence that Britain ever tried to press the Saudis to close down avenues of funding for Islamist groups. Britain's economic dependence on the Saudis was now so great that Whitehall felt unable to challenge any significant policies of its favorite ally, a stance still apparent today. And the next section of the chapter is Bin Laden's London base. And further mention of Bin Laden, I have a note, Bin Laden versus the House of Saud. The London base allowed Bin Laden to motivate his supporters around the world. The perpetrators of the 1995 bomb attacks in Saudi Arabia had read Bin Laden's writings after being faxed to them from London. It was also from London that various of Bin Laden's key fatwas were sent around the world. The ARC, A-R-C, for example, disseminated the English translation of Bin Laden's August 96 declaration of jihad against the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places, calling for the U.S. to be driven from Saudi Arabia, the overthrow of the House of Saud, and Islamic revolution all over the world. 2 years later, in February 98, the ARC published Bin Laden's creation of an international front for jihad against the Crusaders and the Jews, joining together a variety of terrorist groups. However, this caused a little stir in Whitehall, Times journalists Sean O'Neill and Daniel McGrory note. Also instructive is that the British and U.S. intelligence services repeatedly turned down the chance to acquire information on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda in the 90s. In early 95, for example, the Sudanese government, then hosting Bin Laden, offered to extradite or interview him and other key operatives who had been arrested on charges of planning terrorist atrocities. The Sudanese proffered photographs and details on various Arab Afghans, including Saudis, Yemenis, and Egyptians, who had fought in Afghanistan against the Soviets. "We know them in detail," said one Sudanese source. "We know their leaders, how they implement their policies, how they plan for the future. We have tried to feed this information to American and British intelligence so they can learn how things can be tackled." This Sudanese offer was rejected, reportedly due to the, quote, irrational hatred, quote, the U.S. felt for the Sudanese regime, as was a similar subsequent offer made specifically to M16. 3 years later, Britain was also to ignore an arrest warrant for Bin Laden issued by Libya, as we see in Chapter 13. And I'll read the last two pages of this chapter. So safe did Bin Laden's supporters feel in London that, in 1995, they sent overtures to the Home Office inquiring whether their leader could claim political asylum. The then Home Secretary Michael Howard later said that an investigation by his staff into Bin Laden resulted in a banning order being placed on him. In January 96, the Home Office sent a letter to Bin Laden stating that he be excluded from the UK on the grounds that your presence here would not be conducive to the public good. Presumably giving asylum to Bin Laden would have been a step too far for the British in view of their need to be seen to be placating the Saudis. The 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings were not the only terrorist outrages being planned by Bin Laden or those close to him during the period when the ARC was based in London. By late 94, the CIA was designating Bin Laden as a terrorist threat. knowing that his inner circle were working closely with the Sudanese intelligence services, which were, in turn, running terrorist and paramilitary operations in Egypt and elsewhere. In June of 1995, an al-Qaeda team attacked Egyptian President Mubarak's presidential motorcade during a visit to the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. In 1996, a secret CIA analysis showed that the U.S. was aware of bin Laden's financing of Islamic extremists responsible for attempted bombings against 100 U.S. servicemen in Aden in December 92, funneling money to Egyptian extremists to buy weapons and bankrolling at least three terrorist training camps in northern Sudan. After moving to Afghanistan in May 96, bin Laden set up terrorist training groups there under the protection of the Taliban. It beggars belief that British intelligence was also not aware of bin Laden's activities during the period when it tolerated his London base. In contrast to Britain's toleration of the ARC and MIRA, different treatment was meted out to the leader of another Saudi opposition group in London, Mohammed al-Masari, a refugee from Saudi Arabia, who in 94 established the Committee for the Defense of Legitimate Rights. By early 95, the Saudi government was vigorously protesting to Whitehall about al-Masari's attempts to subvert the Saudi regime and threatening to cancel arms deals if the government failed to take action against him. Given the high stakes involved, in April and May of 95, Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd and Prime Minister John Major gave speeches apparently directed at al-Masari, saying that Islamic dissidents were extremely unwelcome in London. The following December, Whitehall, prioritizing arms exports to the Saudis, took the unprecedented step of ordering al-Masari's expulsion and attempted to dispatch him to wherever local authorities could be persuaded, settling on the Caribbean island of Dominica, to whom British aid was quadrupled as a sweetener. However, the British courts ruled that the expulsion would be illegal, the government having failed to show that al-Masari would not be in danger after his removal. According to former CIA officer Robert Baer, the Saudis were behind at least two assassination attempts against al-Masari. It is not clear whether these were in Britain or elsewhere. The Guardian interpreted the Major and Hurd speeches as a sign that the government's stance toward Islamic dissidents was hardening, prompted by Arab governments pressing Britain to clamp down on them. Yet government action was largely limited to al-Masari, clearly to appease the Saudis, while until September 98, other dissidents, like bin Laden's associates, were allowed to go about their business freely. They appeared to operate with the tacit consent of the British authorities, with the most likely reason being that, consistent with the historical record, they were seen as useful to the British. So that's that chapter. The next chapter is Pakistan's surge into Central Asia, and it gets into a chapter on Bosnia, which is where I'm at as recording this. The thing that stood out to me reading that bit was how the in a similar way, the as long as sort of, you know, democracy and people coming together, they don't, the powers don't want that to go too far because that threatens their rule. But then the backlash or the blowback is shown here in the 90s, where this support of, at some levels, funding, weapons, whatever, of these Islamic traditions, or what Curtis calls radical Islam, which I recently read, I forgot who, really shouldn't be called that, because it's more than just Islam that's part of the so-called radicalness. I would call it more extremist. Radical is a cool word, being of the roots. But anyway, my point is that in this chapter, it showed how even the radicals, extremists, had gotten beyond control to the point where then there was division and stirring up trouble with, you know, even with bin Laden and the Saudis, and Britain having to draw the line. So there's like a certain level of control. That's why for some years now, I've sort of summed up the powers as supremacist control freaks, because there's a level of control that helps to keep there are freakish things happening, but when it gets outside of control, both in a detrimental way, as the chapter showed, and both in a positive way, as, say, Standing Rock is showing as a prime example, that they start to freak out. So, many levels of stuff going on, and many factions, ramifications, as that's only up until the 90s. So, keeping up with the stuff is a challenge, but it's, again, one of the reasons this book, why I'm spending so much time with it, and some people several people have expressed appreciation for this series, because it's you know, it's showing so much leading up into what's going on nowadays, and try to have a better handle on, you know, what some people just sort of throw their hands up in the air and say how crazy stuff is. But there is a underlying logic or illogic underlying the lying. And with that little pun, we'll say thank you very much for listening and for your comments, and take care, be peaceful, have a good one.